The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Coming up on episode 282 of Wheel Bearings, it's mostly just Robbie and Sam, but Nicole does pop in with her driving partner Eileen to talk about their cross-country road trip from Disneyland to Disney World in the Kia EV6. We also talk about the Cadillac CT5 and Super Cruise, longer car loans, faked videos, a small electric pickup from GM, car sizes, the Nissan Gobi, and more. All that coming up next. This is episode 282 of Wheel Bearings. I'm Sam Abual Samish from Guidehouse Insights.
And I am Roberto Baldwin from, let's say, Ars Technica this week.
Okay. And I guess you don't have anything that you were driving this week?
I didn't drive nothing. I went to Detroit instead.
Ooh. Well, we'll talk about that later.
Actually, I don't think I was in Detroit at all. I was in Warren.
You probably passed through Detroit, though, going from the airport to Warren.
Yeah, I might have passed through.
Okay. Yeah. Because, I mean, if you took I-94 and then went up 75 to Warren, then you at least passed through part of Detroit.
There we go. So I passed through a portion of Detroit this week. Okay. But mostly I was in Warren.
And Nicole is on the road right now with her Fast Women co-host, Eileen Falkenberg Hall. They have been attempting to set a record for a cross-country EV drive, driving from Disneyland to Disney World. So from California to Florida.
Mouse to mouse.
And well, we'll hear how that's going. She should be calling in about 15 minutes or so. So I last week was driving the 2023 Cadillac CT5 premium luxury all-wheel drive with the 3-liter twin-turbo V6 engine, which is actually a really nice car. I like the CT5 a lot. I like the CT4, too. And if I was spending my own money, I would probably get the CT4 because, I prefer a little bit smaller car. But, if I had need to also carry more than my wife along with me in the passenger seat, and actually wanted to have a couple of adults be comfortable in the back seat, the CT4's back seat is kind of tight. The CT5 is just kind of a nice sweet spot. It's actually a little bit shorter overall than the old CTS that it replaced when it came out in 2019, but it actually has a longer wheelbase, so it's quite roomy inside for its size. And it's got this fastback kind of style to it, even though it is a sedan with a trunk, it's not a hatchback. And the thing that, I've driven the CT5 before, but the thing that I was really particularly interested in with this one, is the latest generation of Super Cruise, which is GM's hands-free, partially automated driving system or driver assist system. And I first drove Super Cruise back in the fall of 2017 when it was first launched. We drove a Cadillac CT6, which is no longer available in North America, from Cleveland to Chicago to Memphis. And it was a really good system then, even with its limitations of what it was capable of. But over time, GM has made it better, and it's available on a lot more vehicles now. And there's currently two iterations of Super Cruise out in the marketplace. There are some vehicles that still have kind of the first, an updated version of the first generation Super Cruise that was on that CT6. That's on the Chevy Bolt EUV and the Cadillac XT6 crossover. And both of those vehicles still have GM's older electrical architecture. So they have the older version of Super Cruise. The new generation of Super Cruise requires GM's VIP, Vehicle Intelligence Platform architecture. And so it's on vehicles like the full-size trucks and SUVs, the Escalades, the Tahoes, Yukons, the Hummer, also the Sierra and Silverado, and it's also on the CT4 and CT5. And this one has capabilities that aren't available in the old one. It's got updated, newer sensors. It's got more compute power, and it's got capability to do over-the-air software updates, which the original didn't, except for maps. And so I spent a good bit of time driving the CT5 on the highway with Super Cruise. And it's gone from, originally they had about 130,000 miles of roads mapped. It's now, let's see, in 2021, they updated that to 200,000 miles, over 200,000 miles of roads. And it expanded from just fully divided interstate type highways to adding some other divided, slightly more rural highways, that you'll find in a lot of parts of the country where they're divided, but they're still, they're not quite fully limited access highways like an interstate. And then last summer they announced they were doubling that to 400,000 miles, adding a bunch of rural roads and other roads. And that updated version has begun rolling out to the full-size trucks and SUVs. They haven't put it on the CT5 yet, so I couldn't try it out on those kinds of roads. But I did try it on some highways and actually recorded a video doing a drive with it and trying out some of the new features like automatic overtaking and auto lane change or lane change on demand. I didn't do any towing with this one, but I did last summer get to try towing on a prototype Sierra at the GM Proving Grounds, and that worked really well. This one I just did the highway driving, and it's really impressive how well the system works. It still has the infrared driver monitor camera on the steering column, and the light bar in the top section of the steering wheel, which I still think is the best human machine interface that any automaker's done for this type of system, because it's really visible. And it's very unambiguous. As it goes from blue, meaning it's ready for Super Cruise, to green, meaning it's active, to red, meaning you need to take over control. Unlike the way that Ford's done it with Blue Cruise, and even BMW on the 7 Series, it's got some LEDs to give you that indicator. But rather than being that whole top segment of the steering wheel, they're in the left and right spokes, and it's better than what Ford's done, but it's not as good as the GM setup. And I haven't had a chance to try Mercedes Drive Pilot yet to see how that configuration works, but I think it's
little lights on the side,
yeah,
on the side of the steering wheel.
Yeah, that's
they're
what
on the steering wheel, but it's like the BMW system.
Okay, so the Super Cruise does a great job of keeping the car really centered in the lane from the very beginning. It's had predictive speed control, so as you're approaching a curve, it looks at what your speed is and what the radius of the curve is, because it's got it all mapped out. If it thinks your speed is a little bit too fast for that curve for it to handle safely, it'll automatically just back off your speed a little bit as you go through the curve and then resume whatever your set speed was. And you can see that, see it doing that in the video on a couple of curves in the highway. And then when you're coming up behind another vehicle, if you, you can go in the settings and you can disable the auto lane change. As well as the lane change on demand, if you don't want it to do that. But if you have that turned on as you're approaching another vehicle, you know, in the past, you know, normally it would just slow down as any adaptive cruise control system would do and maintain a gap to the vehicle in front of you. But with the auto lane changing or auto overtaking, really, when it sees you, when you're approaching that vehicle, it'll start checking the lane to your left. And if it's all clear, it will, in the Cadillac, it has haptic feedback in the seats. So it will buzz the left side of the seat cushion. And also in the instrument cluster, it'll give you an indicator saying, hey, you know, auto lane change. You know, before it does it, it'll tell you it's going to do a lane change. And if you don't want it to change lanes, you can just tap the steering or the turn signal stock and that'll cancel it. So it won't go, it'll just stay in the lane. But if you don't do anything, then when it's clear, it will gently pull over to the next lane, pass the car in front of you. And if it's clear, then it will pull back into the right lane again, has proper lane discipline.
You know, all of you should be pulling over to the right after you
absolutely
pass.
You stay out of the left lane except to pass. You know, stay right except to pass. And then, you know, if there's another car right in front of it, it'll continue, you know, until it finds a clear space to pull back to the right again. So it does what you would expect a well-disciplined driver to do. And it works really well. I still have some skepticism about these systems in general where the human has to supervise the system. You do have to keep your eyes on the road. You know, if you look away from the road for more than a few seconds, it will start to alert you. And if you, you know, if you don't look back at the road, you know, within about 6 or 7 seconds, I think it'll actually start to slow the car down. And if you continue to not respond and take control, then it will eventually bring the car to a full stop, turn on the hazard lights. When you get down below about 40 miles an hour, it turns on the hazard lights and bring the car to a full stop. And if you're non-responsive, you know, I mean, if you've had a medical emergency, for example, or you've just fallen asleep, then it will use OnStar. It'll say, hey, do you need help? You know, I can call for emergency assistance. And if you don't respond to say, no, I'm okay, then it'll call 911 for you and send somebody to your location. Like I said, the system is works really well. You can check it all out in the video that I'll include in the show notes, a link to that. But I generally really like this car. The one I had had the optional 3-liter twin turbo V6. The base engine is a 2-liter 4-cylinder turbo with 237 horsepower, 258 foot-pounds of torque. The V6, 335 and 405 foot-pounds or 550 newton meters of torque, which is why on the trunk lid it says 550T, which is Cadillac's naming convention, you know, the badging convention that they started putting on their vehicles a few years ago. In addition to the vehicle nameplate, they have a number that tells you the vehicle torque, the powertrain torque in newton meters, which of course every American, you know, knows how to easily go back and forth between meters and foot pounds.
As we do, it's something we were taught in school.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's roughly about 1.4 times the number in foot pounds to get newton meters, or divide by 1.4 roughly to get to from newton meters to foot pounds.
Or use Wolfram Alpha. That's my
You could do that too. Or you could just say, you know, hey, G, you know, how many foot-pounds is 550 newton meters? And it'll tell you that, too. Of course, Siri might be able to do it, but I doubt it. The size, I really like the size. You know, it's a mid-size premium sedan. It feels very premium. One thing that I noticed, and I'm not sure when they actually made this change, but I remember back in early 2019 when they were first showing, when they were first revealing the CT5. I went to a backgrounder at the design studio, and they were walking us around, and I was sitting in the car and looking around, and I noticed, you know, with the CT5, they have a central control knob on the console for the infotainment system. And you can rotate it and toggle it. And it's just like a BMW iDrive system. And next to that, there's a volume control. And at least initially, they also had a volume knob next on the screen, on the next to the touchscreen on the top of the dash, and also a volume control on the steering wheel. So you had three different ways to adjust the volume. At some point, they eliminated the one that was on the screen, next to the screen. And so you just have the one on the steering wheel and the one on the console next to your big rotary controller now. But that's fine. You know, the CT5 hasn't yet been upgraded to the new generation infotainment system that's based on Android Automotive, but it does have support for Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, both wireless, which is nice. So you can get in the car. You don't even have to take your phone out of your pocket or purse. It'll just automatically connect, and then you can use your smartphone projection. What else? The trunk is a pretty good size in this thing as well. It's reasonably fuel efficient. You know, it's got good performance. The one I had was all wheel drive. It's got a 10-speed automatic transmission. The EPA fuel economy rating for the four cylinder is 19 city, 27 highway, 22 combined. For the V6, it's one less of each, so 18, 26, and 21 combined. I actually got 22 combined over my week of driving it, which is, you know, quite decent, you know, compared to the, you know, the competition in the segment for this performance level. You know, I mean, it's obviously not great, but you know, it's competitive with the rest of the market. The CT5 has a base price of just over $42,000. The one that I was driving was pretty much loaded with just about everything. And it was priced out at $66,355, including a destination charge. And guess who just joined us as I was speaking? Nicole has dialed in from somewhere in the southeast. Hey, Nicole, how you doing?
Hey. Good. So I am in, where are we? I think we're in Florida. We're in Florida somewhere. I had to think for a second. I'm in Florida.
Hi, Eileen. How you doing?
I'm in the metropolis of Chipley, Florida.
Yeah.
I'm doing great. Welcome to Wheel Bearings.
I'm good. How are you, Sam?
So I don't know if you've listened to the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We have a little bit of a tradition when we're done at the end of our reviews and we talk about pricing. Everybody has to guess what the destination charge is. And since you're new, you want to go first on what you think the destination charge is for a Cadillac CT5?
I know it's far too much, whatever it is. I'm going to guess $1,495.
Nicole, would you like to guess?
I'm not going to be even remotely close, so I'm going to go $1,295.
And Robbie?
Sorry, I had to take my cat out of my room because it was just meowing like crazy. $1,100.
Well, this time Nicole wins. It was $1,395. So Eileen was a little over, and Nicole was just a little under, and Robbie was too low.
I never win, Eileen. I never win.
Well, you're welcome. I have given you the magic powers this week.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. All right. Well, since we've got the two of you, I don't want to necessarily keep you too long. Why are you in Florida?
So we were trying to beat the guys over at TFL Car. They took a Hyundai Ioniq 5 from Disneyland to Disney World, and they drove it straight. Not the idea of, like, speeding, like, as fast as you can, but if you just drove reasonably and efficiently and stopped to charge and sort of figure out where you need to charge, how quickly can you do it? And they did it in 46 hours and 46 minutes. So Eileen and I were trying to beat them in a Kia EV6.
And we were on pace to do it.
We were on pace to do it. Two things spoiled our attempts, which is why we are calling you from a parking lot at a Walmart at a Charger in Florida and not from our final destination. So when we were driving the first half of the drive, the Electrify America Charger, sometimes that's the only ones available for certain stretches of where we were driving. And we had to stop here and charge here. And then we had to get that many miles to get to the next one, and it had to stop at that one and charge at that one. Those chargers, almost all of them were not charging at what they should have been. We were getting charging speeds plugging in of, like, you know, 59. One point it was 12.
Oh. And we're plugged into, like, a 350-watt charger, kilowatt charger. We're not plugged into something that, you know, is only supposed to be, like, a level one or level two.
Yeah. And then they were. Then
so
we
wait. You're telling me you went to Electrify America chargers that didn't work as advertised?
I know. It's weird. Shocking news, Sam. Absolutely shocking news. And in fact, some of them actually, once you plugged in and were connected, would say, "Hey, heads up! Now that you've done all that, our network is in the process of improving itself. So your charging speed may be slowed. Those it tops out at 69. So our 9-minute charging stop would suddenly be an hour. Like, we had to charge to a certain point. It wasn't like, well, let's just go down the road. There's nothing down the road. This is it. So that messed us up. And even that, we were able to overcome that because we were being really careful about the speeds we were driving to make sure we were using the battery as efficiently as humanly possible, topping it off where we could. But then we got to Florida, well, Houston yesterday, yeah, right? Houston,
right outside of Houston.
And we had torrential downpours to the point that you couldn't see where you were going.
And fog. It was combined with fog.
And as we were driving, like, Alabama yesterday?
Louisiana.
There was all of a sudden, there was a point where, like, everybody's hydroplaning off the road. Literally, there's just cars off the road and emergency vehicles. There was an entire truck carrying cars that was off the road this morning.
And not just off the road, into the tree line, people going away in ambulances. It was extremely dangerous.
It was really bad. So last night, at like 40 hours into the deal, we're like, you know what? This is silly. Like, we're not going to risk getting into trouble. So we decided to call it. We pulled over at a hotel, and now we're just going to start back up this morning. We're going to see how long it takes us all together. But, like,
way longer than those guys, even taking out the hotel stop, because we were driving like 45 miles an hour through that rain, you know?
And with the all-wheel drive system working, we had the max defrost on, we had the windshield wipers going, even, you know, conserving power inside the car only to those necessity functions, we still wore down our charge pretty significantly.
Well, the rain, like both the fact that you're fighting wind, you're fighting rain, but also you're fighting the surface tension of the water. I mean, all that like kills.
Exactly. And it was like, Robbie, it wasn't the surface tension. It was the fact that we were fording water like we were driving in a dark Jeep. There was like,
it was the Ark. The EV6 became Noah's Ark last night.
I plugged into charge the last time we charged before we pulled over. And she taps on the window because I'm hiding in the car. I'm like, you go charge the car. I'm hiding in here, right? And she's wearing flip-flops. The water is so deep, it's running over her ankles. Like, she's just standing in a small lake.
And I was on an incline in a parking lot where the water was running. It wasn't like it was just sitting there and stagnant collecting. It was, I have never been that wet, and I shower regularly.
Well, I'm glad that you both stayed safe. Because I did see a headline a little while ago about some tornadoes and thunderstorms that also came through central Alabama yesterday, and some people did not fare so well. So I'm glad that both of you are both safe. Overall, how has setting aside, well, actually, first, you talked about Electrify America and your challenges there. But I know from following you on Instagram over the last couple of days, that wasn't the only network that you used, right?
Yeah, we used EVgo. And EVgo was fine. We had no problems with it. I think we used EVgo once or twice.
Twice.
And we used ChargePoint once. And ChargePoint, also fine. No issues. You drove up, plugged in, charged, got a reasonable amount of kilowatt hours. Like, you looked like, yep, that seems right, given where we pulled in as far as our state of charge when we pulled in and how it ramped up and how it ramped down. Everything seemed fine.
That station that we used for ChargePoint was in California, and it actually maxed out for us. It was running full max the entire way, like it should. Like, that was the most operable of all stations we visited.
Yeah, so that one was really good. So, you know, other chargers, and we have since had, like, we're an Electrify America charger right now, and we're getting, and I can tell you, what are we getting? We're getting, we just got over 80%. We just tipped over 80% charge, and we're down to 89 kilowatts.
But when it was running full steam, it was about 200, 205.
Yeah, so okay. This one's fine.
That's a good click.
Right? So you get them when they work. They're great, like, and they'll be fine. But when they don't work, you're like, seriously, 7? And it was like, I just remember sitting in a parking lot, and it was 7 kilowatts coming out of that dang thing. There was no other charger. There were 4 in this lot. 3 of them didn't work. We were the only one that would work. Had to plug into every single one to find out that they didn't work.
Oh. And we were on the border, in a border town surrounded by Customs Border Protection vehicles, at a Days Inn in a parking lot full of stray dogs.
Yeah, it was super safe.
At like 2 o'clock in the morning. So just like all those factors together, that was a very limiting experience.
So how about the car? You mentioned, you know, that it handled well in the torrential rain, but how's it been overall?
Despite the challenges with the charging and the weather, the car has been fantastic. And like we were saying yesterday, truly horrible rain amounts on the road. Like, the road literally had inches of water just cascading across it. You could feel that you were driving through water. You can feel the resistance of the water under the wheels. But the car handled beautifully. The all-wheel drive system in this did not miss a beat. We had no problems. There's Continental tires. I forget which Continental, True Contact, something Contact. They've got good tires in the car that are actually rated. We looked it up to be good in the water. We're like, heck yes. The tires did really well. We never felt like I knew I was driving in water. You could hear it. But I never felt like, oh gosh, I'm in danger of slipping. Like, I need to slow down. And it was more we were stopping because the fear was, like, I was watching people on the road who were almost running into each other as they were sliding. And it was like, it's not so much me, it's the other guy.
Yeah,
you know
it's
what I mean?
Somebody in like an old F-150 doing 80 miles an hour. Like, I don't need to slow down. And then their back end just slides out and hits you.
Exactly. Where I finally called it and said, that's it. We came over a crest. There's, you know, emergency vehicles on the side of the road. And there's a Cadillac Escalade in the woods. I'm like, I'm out. This is it. Like, I don't want to get hit by a Cadillac Escalade. We got to pull over. We got to stop. The Escalade.
Wise decision.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So we did get a question from a listener specifically for the two of you from Gifted Napper, who has sent us questions in the past. He posted this one on Mastodon last night. It says, I'm wondering how the two of you like or don't like the dual function audio and climate control buttons. I tried them once and it was almost a deal breaker on the car for me. Curious if you get used to it over time or if it's still just as annoying.
Okay, I got used to it. I'm not keen on it. It's a little frustrating. It's especially frustrating, like, you're trying to adjust the climate. Like, I'm driving, right? And it's driving, it's night, it's not great conditions, I'm trying to adjust the climate. I have to change, but if I don't change the button and then adjust the climate fast enough, now it's not on climate again. Wait, I got to put it back on climate, put it on climate again, adjust the heat. I find them frustrating. Eileen, what did you think?
I don't care for it. I like it in theory a lot more than I like it in reality. And I also have trouble with the climate control itself. I don't care for the way it dispenses the air and diversifies the air. I don't care for it. Like, the automatic climate control is not where I want to be in life.
Okay.
I've used it too. And what I end up doing is leaving on climate control and then using the volume controls on the steering wheel. But I still will turn that wheel, that little knob, and be like, oh, it's getting warmer.
Yeah.
So, aside from the challenges with charging, assuming that were to someday potentially get fixed, you know, having driven almost all the way across the country now in an EV.
Yes. Yes.
Would you say that an EV is a viable vehicle to have as a single vehicle that you could use for anything, including a cross country drive?
Okay, yeah, technically, yes, you can do it. Yes, I would be tempted to not have, if I did road trips all the time, if for some reason I was doing this every couple months, I probably wouldn't have an EV be my only choice. Because let's assume even that the network works, right? Let's assume I walk up to every charger, it works, it charges what it's supposed to. There still aren't enough of them. So you end up in locations like, we were in some pretty sketchy locations.
We watched a drug deal.
We did. We watched a drug deal in one parking lot.
That's just a small business. I don't know why you're...
we thought it was a prostitution thing, and we were relieved it was just a drug
deal. It's like, oh, no, she's just walking out with a little baggie. Okay, it's drugs. But, like, so if you're traveling a lot, like, do you want to stop? Not even just yourself. You and your wife and your kids, right? Do you want to stop in a sketchy parking lot in the middle of nowhere where they're doing a drug deal to charge your car up in the middle of the night because there's literally nowhere else to take it? Like that. So I don't think it's ideal for long distance road trips. I would still not hesitate to buy an EV as my second car in a heartbeat. But I think if you're a long distance road tripper, like a PHEV is a better choice. You can still get some electric vehicle use out of it, but you don't have to stop in that sketchy parking lot to charge. You don't have to worry about finding, you know, there's four different chargers. You back to the first one. No, you back to the second one. No, you back to the third one. No. And you're thinking, oh God, if this fourth one doesn't work, I am in the middle of nowhere with just Border Patrol here to help me. Like it's not ideal driving across country yet. You can do it 100%. Is it easy to do? Absolutely not.
Okay. Well, since I know you're already over 80% charge, I'm sure the two of you probably want to get this thing over with. So any last thoughts before we let you go?
No, this was really fun. You know, even though we didn't beat TFL, stupid Roman still wins the record there. This was a really great experience. We learned a lot about driving with EVs, and it makes me feel like I understand the challenges, the pros and cons of it a lot better than I did before. And it was a fun experience. As much as the crazy, the drug deals, the prostitutes, the whatever else, the water, it was still a lot of fun. And we talked to a lot of cool people along the way who were asking about the car, talking about vehicle charging. There's a lot of excitement for EVs, so it was fun. I enjoyed it.
I concur. I would do it again. I'd love to do it in a different vehicle with a little more range.
Yeah.
So are you guys still, are you both still going to go to Disney World? Do you get to go have
fun? I am. Eileen wasn't ever, but yeah. Are you, do you Eileen. Even know me? Yes, I'm going to Disney World. Duh.
All right, just double.
I'm going to a bar and then going to a plane and flying home because I haven't been home in a week and a half.
Home. Who needs home when you have the Disney characters?
All right. Well, thank you for calling in. And for those that haven't listened to the Fast Women podcast, if you want to hear more of Nicole than you hear here and also hear Eileen's thoughts, make sure you check out that show every week as well, because it's a great show.
Just non-stop.
All right,
Nicole.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
All right. Let's get into a few items for this week. First up, Robbie, what's the longest car loan you've ever gotten?
3 years. I know there's 5 years. I know then they just keep getting longer and longer. And in my brain, I'm just like, if I can't afford a car after 3 years, then I shouldn't be buying that car. That's my thought process, because I'm very cheap. But also, I feel like I'm being a little bit responsible, but mostly I'm just cheap.
Well, no, I mean that is a very reasonable thing to do, a very reasonable response. And you know, I mean, there's being cheap, you know, and you've also got to, you know, everybody's got to watch their budget. I mean, you know, unless you are wealthy, which none of us are, at least none of us recording the show, you know, we have budgets that we have to work within. We have a certain amount that we can afford to spend on transportation every month, having a car loan that, you know, stretches almost as long as your mortgage, to me does not seem like a great idea. In the last couple of years, loans have been getting, as cars have been getting more and more expensive, in order to try to get lower monthly payments, a lot of people have been shifting towards these longer interest loans. And, you know, until this past year, when interest rates started going up, and when you could get, you know, if you had reasonable credit, you know, you could get interest rates, you know, for under 2% in most cases on a car loan. You know, a lot of people have shifted to 6 and 7 year loans. And I think in Canada, even 8 year loans are increasingly common.
Yes.
You know, so 96 month loans. But according to a story from the Drive, actually, I guess it originally came from Automotive News, by the end of October of 2022, nearly a fifth of new car buyers last year had gone for 7 year loans on a car, which to me is just bonkers.
I remember when 5 year loans came along and people were like, why would you do that? Why, that's insane. And now I think those are pretty much the norm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The longest I've ever done is 4 year loans. You know, even that, you know, is a fairly long time, but you know, when the average price of a new car, the average transaction price is nearly $50,000 now, you know, unless you have somehow managed to save up, you know, $20,000-$25,000 for a down payment, you know, then you might not be able to afford a payment longer than, more than what it would cost for a 5 year, you know, a 4 year, or, you know, a 5 year loan, because you know the shorter your terms are, you know, the shorter the loan term is, you know, the more your monthly payment's going to be, and that, you know, is often the deciding factor for most car buyers, you know, in terms of what they can buy. Is what is the monthly payment? You know, what can I afford to spend every month on this thing, and know that I'm going to be able to pay for it and fit it in my budget?
Yeah, yeah. And that's that. And the unfortunate part is that if you just want a regular nice car, you're paying all so much money. And if you're like, okay, well, you know, I live somewhere where I need a car. I have to get to work. I have to take my kids to school, or I have to, you know, I have things I have to do. I need a car that'll fit this many people. I'll do this thing. And I'm like, oh, it's $35,000. Okay. And you think about that, like, oh, that's $500 a month for like a 3 year loan. You're like, well, I can't afford $500 a month. So I'm going to have to eat that extra, you know, you're paying more over the long run because you're getting a longer loan, because you're paying more towards the interest than you are to the actual car, because your loan is longer. And you're just, cars are too expensive is the loan.
Yeah. And, you know, especially EVs, I know, you know, last time I checked a few months ago, you know, the average transaction price for all vehicles in the U.S. was almost $49,000. And for EVs, it was $66,000. Now, hopefully, this year that will start to moderate, later this year when we start to see some less expensive new EVs coming to market, like the Chevy Equinox, which is supposed to start at $30,000. That'll help. And hopefully some of the price increases that we've seen on EVs will start to get, because of increased battery prices, will start to hopefully get rolled back a little bit as the battery material costs start to moderate as well. But it's going to be a challenge.
I will say I had a friend who just bought a Ioniq 5 like yesterday, and they were saying that they were getting the car for $9,000 less than the person who was supposed to buy the car, and that the dealership seemed like they were like really trying to sell the car, like because the lot was full. So I think we're hopefully coming out of the whole supply chain issue where someone's going to rip you off in order to get a car because there's only three cars on the lot. So this is anecdotal evidence based on a friend from text messaging, but hopefully for people who are buying cars, who have to buy a car right now, it's not going to be nearly as horrible on your bank account.
Yeah, and I have seen a couple of other reports in the past week that car prices are starting to slow down a little bit. Although that's not universal across the board. Actually, just saw somebody posted on Twitter, which I'm just checking into for notifications, a sticker from a Toyota dealer in North Wilkesboro, North Carolina, for a Corolla GR. The MSRP on this car is $38,945. They have something called the Millennium Package for $995, Classic Package for another $995, and then a $19,995 market adjustment, as well as $799 for documentation fees, and then $1,851 for tax, and then another $205 for non-tax fees. Whatever that means.
What is this?
For a grand total of $63,785 for a Corolla GR.
I mean, that's all. We're always going to get hosed on those cars, though.
Yeah,
that's the problem with those like short run enthusiast vehicles. Is they know they're going to find some kid who's super into that vehicle, or some parent, or who's happy to buy their child a vehicle, or someone like me who's won the lottery for some reason. Somehow I've won the lottery and now I'm driving. I'm going to go buy a GR Corolla for $70,000. Like I got angry because I have the BRZ, and I was like, well, I can sell this for 22, but if I want to buy a new one for a $30,000 car, the markup in the Bay Area is $13,000 to $15,000.
That's
that's
stupid.
50% of the price.
Yeah. No,
I just walked. I actually laughed out loud at the Toyota dealership because I went. I had to take the Hyundai in to get like the wheels rotated or something, and so I walked down to the Toyota dealership and they had a GR86 in the thing, and I laughed out loud very because I was like, oh, it can't be as bad as the one that my friends sent me from the Subaru dealership earlier that week, and I was like, ha! And I just turned around and walked out.
All right. Next up, let's see. I don't know. You may have all seen at some point over the last several years. It's been actually it's been over 6 years now since it was originally posted. Tesla posted a video that is still on the Tesla website on the autopilot page, which is commonly referred to as the Paint It Black video, because the soundtrack to the video is the Rolling Stones song Paint It Black. And it's a time-lapse video that purports to show a Tesla Model X driving itself around the Palo Alto area where Tesla was headquartered until they moved to Texas. And the opening title card on the video says, this car is driving itself. The driver, the person is only behind the wheel for legal reasons. Well, it turns out that it wasn't showing quite really what was being claimed. Back in 2018, an Apple engineer named Walter Wong crashed his Model X on the 280. I don't know if he's coming home from work or going to work.
He was heading to work.
Okay, in Silicon Valley, and he had been using autopilot, and he was not holding onto the wheel as the instructions explicitly tell you to, and not really watching the road apparently. And he, prior to this crash, he had reported to Tesla and to Tesla customer support at least 7 times that, you know, the car was not behaving properly and it was veering towards the center median on this stretch of road. And yet he continued to use it. And ultimately on that last day, the car crashed into the center median and he was unfortunately killed. And his family subsequently sued Tesla for wrongful death. And that trial is about to get started. And some of the documentation from the discovery process in that trial has now been released. And the director of Autopilot Software, whose name I can't find at the moment, but in his deposition for this trial, he acknowledged that the video was staged. He was asked about this video and said, you know, acknowledged that it was staged. It was not done in one single run, as Tesla has purported for the last 6 years. It took many takes, you know, and cutting together the video to get what appears, you know, from watching the video, a clean run. And because it's not done, the video is not in real time, it's a time lapse, you know, it's a lot easier to fake that sort of thing. And he also acknowledged that Tesla CEO Elon Musk approved it and, in fact, encouraged it. He said, just a quote here from the deposition, just want to be absolutely clear that everyone's top priority is achieving an amazing autopilot demo drive, Musk said in an email. Since this is a demo, it's fine to hard code some of it, since we will backfill it with production code later in an OTA update. Referring to the temporary code. And what they had actually done is, rather than just putting in a destination and having the car navigate itself to that destination, they had hard-coded in a specific route and what lanes to use and everything. So basically the whole thing, you know, is unrepresentative of the way the car actually behaves.
Back in the before times, there were a lot of autonomous startups, and they would drag me to Las Vegas or wherever to show me off. And it was almost always on a route. This is the route we're using. We're going to use this route, and the car is doing. It's just driving along a route, which is essentially, you know, it's like a remote control car. You're just controlling it from a route. There's someone in the car, but telling something. This is what lane you should be in. This is what you do. This is the without it actually having to figure that out, that's not actually autonomous driving.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's autonomous to the degree that, you know, it has to react to some things in real time, like other vehicles, pedestrians, and so on. But, you know, it's not what Tesla claimed it to be.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it still isn't today. You know, the so-called full self-driving beta that they have today still is not capable of it. It's more capable than what was in this video in terms of just putting in a destination and it'll try to figure out a route and try to get you there. But it's not capable of doing it in a way that is safe and reliable, that you can just take your hands off the wheel and sit back and relax. You do have to be paying very close attention because it frequently does the wrong thing at the wrong time.
It's, you know, it's funny because, you know, Tesla no longer has a press department. But when they did, and I was getting cars from them, I would make sure in my videos and in my articles when I was writing about the Teslas that I would say, this is not a self-driving car. I was very, you know, I wanted to make sure that people who bought this car, who were thinking about buying this car, knew that it was not a self-driving car. And the press team would thank me for that. They thank you so much for saying that. We really appreciate you doing that because somebody else who worked at Tesla, let's say the CEO, was constantly like, you're showing like people like, hey, it drives by itself, it does this. But the reality is, and the reality that the press department has to deal with, is the fact that it's not a self-driving car. And I would write these articles, or I shoot these videos, and they go online, and I would get emails, and I would get DMs, and I would get, you know, at reply, you don't know what you're talking about, it's a self-driving car, da-da-da-da-da. And either these people were either Tesla owners or people who just saw the hype. They saw this video and they're like, oh, it's a self-driving car. I'm like, no, it's not a self-driving car. Tesla is actually – and I just don't reply. I don't know what to tell these people, because nothing I say is going to change their mind at this point. And, you know, the fact that the press team would tell me thank you. And it was also funny when Tesla would show me how to use a feature. Like, this is a new feature. This is how you use it. I'm like, oh, okay. And so that's how I would use the feature. This is how you use it. I do it in the video, and people would send me messages. That's not how you use that. I'm like, the people who built this, they had an engineer come out and show me how it works and explain to me what's going on in the car. But yeah, you random dude. It's always a dude, random dude on Twitter. You know better than the actual Tesla engineer who built this. Fine.
Yeah, and the title card in the video that I was looking for before says, the person in the driver's seat is only there for legal reasons. He is not doing anything. The car is driving itself, which it was not. Yeah. At the end of the video, it's about a four-minute video, and I'll put a link to it you can watch. The engineer steps out of the vehicle. The driver's side door appears to shut itself, and the vehicle parallel parks in space with no one at the wheel. However, in the course of filming this, it took several tries to actually get it to do that, including one attempt in which it ran into a fence at Tesla's headquarters in Palo Alto. So,
I always feel bad. There used to be where their Palo Alto headquarters was. It was like surrounded by like horses.
Yeah.
The only autonomous vehicle you can really get, to be honest, is a horse. You don't have to do anything. The horse will just go where it needs to go. Yeah. But I was always like concerned about them hitting a horse.
the director of autopilot software who was in the deposition, his name was Ashok Elaswamy. One of the questions that he was asked as well, another question he was asked, was about operational design domains. So in developing automated driving systems, you know, they use the term operational design domain. So what are the limits of where the system can operate? So like, can it operate in daylight? Can it operate 24 hours a day? What kind of weather? What locations? And so the ODD is just, these are the criteria that the engineers have set as the limitations for where the system can operate. When it gets outside of that, and you know, for Super Cruise as an example, you know, the original ODD was divided highways. You know, and they've gradually expanded that to more kinds of roads since then. Elaswamy was asked about, you know, what is an operational design domain? And his answer to the question was, I don't know. This guy is the head of autopilot software and didn't know, you know, everybody in this industry knows what an ODD is. He was either lying and saying he didn't know, or if he was telling the truth that he didn't know, this is not somebody who should be in any way involved with developing automated driving systems. So anyway, I don't want to go on too long about this one, but just, you know, be careful out there if you've got a Tesla or any other vehicle with any kind of partial automation. You know, be aware of what it can do, and more importantly, be aware of what it can't do. And don't try to explore the limits. You know, it's not safe for you. And it's also not safe for other people using the roads, because you're not alone on the roads. We have to share the roads with other drivers, with pedestrians, with cyclists, with animals, and they did not consent to being part of an experiment. So
those horses, forget about the horses.
Yeah, the horses. You know, be respectful of other road users, and do not try to whether you're. You're trying out your automated driving system, or you know, you're just taking your sports car out, you know, for a Sunday morning drive. You know, be respectful of others on the road.
Yeah.
All right. One of the segments that has really popped up in the auto industry over the last year and a half, and is starting to gain some real traction, is small pickup trucks. They finally came back, and you know, we've been quite effusive in our endorsement of both the Ford Maverick and the Hyundai Santa Cruz. And now GM is apparently finally looking at doing a small pickup truck.
Yeah, so so Hannah Lutz wrote something over at Auto News. We both saw this. We were actually in the same group. We both talked at the same time. Hannah just writes faster than me. I have an article going up on Ars Technica next week about this. But as Hannah points out, that we went into a design studio where they were showing us design studies for what GM is thinking for a sub $30,000 EV. And the first study was under a black sheet.
Silk.
And silk. And it looked like, well, you know, it kind of looked like a baby Bronco. So I don't think Hannah, I don't know if Hannah mentioned this in her article, but there was like this little, you know, it looked like a small, like, sport utility with the little tire on the back. Cause, you know, you throw that tire on the back and suddenly everything's cool. And then they had a crossover that was a bit more dynamic than the Equinox coming. And then they had a wagon that was also under Silk, which, you know, Americans don't want. like, ooh, a wagon. and then at the very end, it is very small truck, this little tiny pickup. It's, you know, it seats two, it has a 4.5-foot bed, it's very low slung. And what I mentioned in my Ars Technica piece is that it reminds me of the Nissan Gobi a bit.
Oh, but, yeah.
But remember the Gobi from 1990? I remember being obsessed with the Gobi, by the way, when it showed up in all the glossies. Like, we just kept talking about the damn Nissan Gobi with my friend so much so he wanted me to shut up about it. but if it's a little bit more low slung, it's a bit more dynamic, and it's built for, you know, going to the beach and you know, throwing your surfboard in the back and all this stuff. And while that design probably won't happen, you know, it does show that GM is definitely looking at that small pickup market that Ford and Hyundai have returned to. And I'm doing quite well with, and everyone else for some reason just kept ignoring because they're like, "We'll just make bigger and bigger pickups," which I understand the profit margins on a pickup are bonkers versus the profit margins on a cheap small pickup, less bonkers. But at the end of the day, people really like, I mean, that Ford Maverick, people are buying that thing like gangbusters. And in addition to that vehicle, we did a, I don't know, Zoom call essentially with the California Design Studio, and they showed us a small truck, which is about the size of a Maverick, but lifted. And they didn't show – it was under Silk, but he lifted up just a little corner so we could see the bumper and a little bit of the grill. And the grill looked a bit like a Hummer, so it was like a small EV Hummer. They kept saying sustainable. It's, you know, extreme sustainability, and they kept saying off-road and whatnot. So it's not too far-fetched to think that they're doing a Maverick or Ford – you know, Ranger-sized, off-road, tinier Hummer for, I guess, the rest of us. And that would likely be more expensive. That's probably like a $50,000 car. But the fact that they showed off two smaller trucks, both of them EVs, during this tour of the Warren, Michigan facility, is good news for people who, frankly, they want something they can haul stuff with. That's not, you know, doesn't start at $50,000, $60,000. Not everyone needs an F-150 or even a Ford Ranger. You know, again, after driving that Maverick, I still think about the Maverick. I still have the wood that I cut for it to put in the back for the video. So I still am like, maybe we should get a Ford Maverick.
I mean, you know, looking at the Gobi again, you know, I'm reminded of the Dodge Rampage and the VW Rabbit pickup of the mid '80s.
Oh, it does. It's like a Gobi and a Dodge Rampage had a little baby. that's kind of what now that you think, I completely forgot about the Rampage. I haven't even looked. I don't even have to look at the Rampage. I can see it in my mind's eye.
Yeah. So, you know, do you think that a two seat pickup of this size would actually be appealing in the U.S. market? I mean, I can see where it would have an appeal, you know, in some other markets. I'm not so sure about the U.S. market.
The U.S. market's got to be a four-door. It's not going to be a small – it was smaller – you know, this vehicle was smaller than the Maverick. But the U.S. market, we need, you know, you gotta have that, those extra two doors. You gotta be able to throw two people in the back, or your dogs, or, you know, the car seat situation. That's a huge deal. You know, you need that, you know, that rear seat in order to feel better about that, because you don't want to shove them in the front and then remember to turn off the airbag and, you know, all that stuff. So yeah, no, I don't think a two-door pickup in you. I mean, you can get a single cab truck. I've seen like two.
Yeah.
in the last year, like brand new, but no one's buying
those. I mean, the only customers that buy those really anymore are, you know, some fleets.
Yeah.
You know, that, like, you know, local municipal fleets, you know, will buy them, you know, for their parks crews, parks cleanup crews.
Yeah, like, yeah. You see them for the parks crews. I've only seen two outside of, like, all the park, like the state, regional, and national park crews. Everyone else is getting that extra cab, or king cab, or super cab, or mega cab, or ultra cab, right.
And,
whatever.
You know, and when Ford launched the Lightning last year, you know, we asked them about, you know, would they do a two-door, you know, a standard cab version, or even extended cab. And he said, well, we could, but, you know, 85% of all F-150 sales are, you know, this crew cab short bed configuration, you know, and they just didn't see enough potential demand for a standard cab version of it. So, you know,
especially
they
as
like
an
do
EV.
It at some point. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially with EVs, because you're really trying to make as much money. And that, you know, when we talk to them, you know, it's really, you know, as they're looking at a sub $30,000 vehicle, it's really about trying to figure out how you can build a vehicle that doesn't have too much R&D, because that goes into the cost. It doesn't have too much development. You can say, okay, here are all the designs. And then you have to figure out, okay, which of these, if we have two of them or three of them, can we use parts from other vehicles, but, you know, non-customer facing parts, so it doesn't just look like a parts bin car. And so there's a lot of thought that goes into making an inexpensive car, because it has to be an inexpensive car from beginning to end, from idea to, you know, selling it to you on the lot. You know, you can't spend, you know, billions of dollars doing R&D to make a $25,000 EV, because you're losing money. It's not just the actual manufacturing of the vehicle. It's everything about that. And so, you know, it's you know, they have to think about that, and they have to think about, you know, we can't, you know, they don't want to put a $25,000 vehicle that no one wants to buy. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing. So, you know, they have to do, like, focus. You know, I talked to them about focus groups and or auto shows, like, which is better. And they're saying, well, focus groups are actually a little bit better, because you can ask why they don't like something. Well, you know, they can ask people to elaborate, because you put a concept car at a show, and you ask everybody how much they like it, and they're like, oh, yeah, I love this. You know, this is great. But if you put them in a focus group and you say, hey, you can be mean about this car, and they can, okay, well, this is what
– Tell us what you really think.
Yeah, tell us what you really think. So if you get on one of those groups, I don't know, small trucks and wagons, just be the person who we talked a little bit about this. He's like, you know, who loves wagons, designers, and auto journalists.
Yeah, pretty much.
And Europeans. That's it. Yeah. Designers, automotive journalists, and Europeans. He's like, it's cool. It's a fun design. It's a fun design piece. But if no one's going to buy it, and, you know, we have wagons in this country, and, like, Volvo had some really nice wagons, and just no one was buying them. You're just like,
yeah,
you know, tried.
Given the choice of, you know, a Volvo V60 or an XC60, Volvo customers bought the XC60.
Overwhelmingly bought the XC60. Yeah. That's their number one selling vehicle.
Which is unfortunate, but that's, you know, it's just the reality of the situation.
So
save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards. Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right. Well, speaking of big cars, one last item. Over on the bird site, our friend Brianna Wu posted something this morning, a screen grab from a site that she found called carsized.com. And that's sized, you know, kind of like with a D on the end. And she posted it. And what you can do in there is you can pick two vehicles, and it overlays them on top of each other, and you can have it line them up, you know, by wheelbase, or, you know, line them up the front end or the back end. So you can compare the difference in size. And she put her her Boxster on there with a GMC Sierra pickup. You know, the Boxster definitely fit within the outer limits of the tires, not quite within the wheelbase. And so I went there and put the Miata on there, and the Miata pretty much fits within between the axles of a Sierra, of a crew cab Sierra. And so you can go through, and there's, you know, I think it's actually a European site because there's a lot of European brands on there as well. But you can find most cars, you know, from at least, you know, over the last couple of decades, and you can compare the sizes and see. You know, even take the same vehicle from different generations and see how they've changed and grown. And they have grown. They've gotten bigger.
Oh, yeah. I love to tell a story about the time we went to do a car shoot. I think it doesn't matter. And there was a CRX there, and we were like, oh, we were waiting for this the owner to come back so we could talk to them about their CRX. And while they were gone and while we were doing our shoot, Nissan, like, I think it was a Nissan Versa. No, it was a Toyota. What's the tiny Toyota?
The Tercel?
No, maybe it wasn't Nissan.
Yaris?
Anyway, Yaris, that's what it was. The Yaris showed up. And,
they keep changing the name. Yeah, so.
Yeah, so the Toyota Yaris showed up, and it's huge. The CRX just looks so tiny next to the Yaris, which if you'd see it on the road now, and you see it in a lineup at a showroom, it's just such a small car. But it was just so much bigger than the CRX.
Well, you know, it's funny. I remember back like 2009 or something, I was doing a first drive review of the second generation Honda Fit for Autoblog. And, you know, in looking at the dimensions of this thing, I decided to go back and pull up the specs for the original 1976 Honda Accord. You know, and the Accord was considered, at that time, was Honda's bigger car because it was quite a bit bigger than the Civic of that generation. And the 2009 Fit was about 8 inches longer than the first generation Accord, which, you know, at that time and now, you know, is considered a large car. You know, it's no longer a compact car. It's a large car by EPA standards. And the Fit, you know, was bigger, you know, smaller than the then current Accord, but quite a bit larger than the first generation Accord, and a lot roomier. I remember a friend when I was in college had one of those first generation Accords. You know, we were carpooling to work, I remember, you know, what that one felt like. And, you know, my daughter had a 2008 Fit, first gen Fit, you know, and that thing felt so roomy compared to those old Accords. And it's, you know, it's amazing how, you know, how these things have grown over the years.
Yeah, they just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And like, if you drive a car, a friend of mine went and drove a Datsun B something. I don't remember which one he drove. It doesn't matter. He's like, he has a GTI. He's had a Prius. He's had a bunch of cars. And he's just like, I haven't not been in a car from the 70s in a very long time. I felt like it's just, there's nothing. It's just you and so, and a slab of, like, a tiny sliver of aluminum and the road. He's like, I felt unsafe because, you know, those doors were just like metal, glass, you know, for your window and the little mechanism to roll the window and open the door, and then, like, you know, some little panel. That's it. It was super thin. And he's like, I felt like
I was like in my Miata too.
Yeah, I felt like I was just like in the road. I'm like, well, that's how old cars were. We just didn't think about it back then because we're like, oh, this is how all cars are. Now there's such a huge, like, chunk of, like, car between you and the road, just just for a lot of reasons, and a lot of them safety.
And you know, funny thing is, you know, a lot of people talk about how much heavier cars have gotten, and I wrote an article a few years back that, you know, and that's true up to a point, at least, you know, prior to EVs. With EVs, we have taken a big jump in weight, but with gas engine cars, you know, if you compare generations of a particular nameplate, like, say, let's take the Honda Civic. If you compare today's Honda Civic to a Civic from the 1970s or early 80s, yeah, it is a lot bigger and it's a lot heavier. But what I actually found was that, if you actually compare, because, you know, what typically happens is any given nameplate over from generation to generation typically gets larger and moves up in size class. So, you know, the original Civic was, you know, sub compact, you know, and today it's, you know, pretty much a mid-sized car. Mm-hmm. But if you look at similar sized cars, you know, similar length and width from today versus 30 or 40 years ago, they're actually not that much heavier. In fact, in many cases, they're the same or lighter, despite the fact that these modern cars are way stronger and can withstand, you know, if you took a 1980s Honda Civic and did a modern crash test with it, you know, it would just crumple up into a little ball.
Yeah.
And, you know, nobody would walk away from it. And you do the same thing with a modern Civic, and, you know, you can walk away from that. I was at Honda a couple of years ago, and they did a demo of the small offset rigid barrier test with a Civic, and you could still open and close the doors after the crash test. And you know, that same Civic compared to a similar sized car of 40 years ago actually weighs about the same. Now it's got, you know, 8-10 airbags in it and all these other features that weren't in those cars, and it's so much stronger. So, you know, they've made a lot of advances in materials and everything else. It's just that, you know, at the same time, consumers have also demanded larger vehicles, so that if they would just stay in the same size vehicle, you know, they could get a lot more without getting heavier. But they've gotten into bigger and bigger and bigger vehicles, you know, so now we have 9,500 pound Hummer EVs. And it's sad.
It's, you know, but there was a good video a few years ago from Toyota, from an older Toyota, a new Toyota. Or maybe it was, I don't know if it was from Toyota, it's from somebody, but I think it was like the old Tercel or the old Camry or the old Corolla. I guess not Tercel, since that's not, you can't buy a Tercel anymore. But I think the older Corolla or the older Camry versus the new one, and just the crash, essentially the crash test of both of those vehicles. And you're like, oh, this is why you buy your kid a newer car.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, and GM did that with, I think about 10 years ago with a then current generation Malibu and the original first generation Malibu from the late 60s and crashed them into each other. And, you know, same thing, you know, the modern Malibu, you know, you could open and close the doors and walk away. The other one, you know, just crumpled up, you know, even though it was a larger car, you know, it was just totally destroyed.
Sheesh. Yeah.
All right. Let's answer a couple of questions.
Who's got questions?
First up from Jonathan Brown says, love the podcast, yet I wonder where a 40% increase in sales for any automotive company is considered lacking. And this is referring to Tesla announcing their end of year sales results a couple of weeks ago, where, you know, their overall deliveries, global deliveries for 2022 were up 40% compared to 2021. In a year where supply issues are still an issue for any automotive company, an increase in unit sales, in my opinion, is impressive. 40% is amazing. Personal opinions are always welcome, yet when political bias by automotive journalists and hosts is so obviously biased, respect for professionalism can be diminished. A dislike for Elon Musk as a human being is sadly biased. Well, I don't agree with that.
But, before we keep going, I'm going to say I do not like Elon Musk. I have a lot of friends who work at Tesla, and I know a lot of people who work at Tesla, and they're smart and they're wonderful people, and I do not want Tesla to go away. Mm-hmm. I want Tesla to be run by an adult. That's it. I think what Tesla has done, and it's a group effort. It wasn't just Elon Musk, is amazing, but you also have to take into account that the man is insane.
Yeah. And I totally agree with that. And just to finish up Jonathan's note, Musk's purchase of Twitter and opening it up from political bias one way or the other is, again, a challenging event for those who preferred the previous use of Twitter. Fun podcast, even if we disagree. If we all agreed, life would be boring. I'm really just suggesting a slightly better balance. The new Corvette E-Ray releasing on 117 should be quite the attracting discussion for your podcast. I agree with what you said, you know, about Tesla as a company. And we've said this a lot over the years. You know, I totally respect what Tesla has done in terms of inspiring the rest of the industry to do better with EVs. And, you know, we're starting to see that impact now across the industry. You know, Tesla was the first to really demonstrate that a modern EV could be something so much more than just a basic economy car.
Compliance.
It could be...
We'd all be driving compliance cars still if it wasn't for Tesla.
Or Nissan Leafs, you know, with 70-mile ranges.
Boo.
It's not just on the electrification side, but, you know, what they've done with electrical architecture, with software, you know, there's a lot that they've done to inspire huge changes in the way the automotive industry operates. And that's good. And they deserve credit for that. But they also, at the same time, deserve condemnation for the way they've handled autopilot and full self-driving, which we already talked about earlier. The 40% increase in sales, you know, considered lacking. You know, I think overall, you know, on its own, I don't think anybody necessarily considers a 40% jump in sales, especially in 2022 when most companies were struggling to build, you know, everything they could. That's not the issue. The issue with Tesla is that, you know, right up until, you know, well into the fourth quarter, Tesla was still projecting that they were going to have a 50% increase in sales. And most of the disappointment at a 40% increase in sales was not necessarily from people like us. It was from
Wall Street,
from financial analysts who, you know, made their stock pricing projections, assuming, you know, based on the guidance that Tesla was giving them. And Tesla fell short of their guidance. And this happens in every industry to every company where the company falls short of the guidance. I'm not saying it's a good thing. You know, I think that, you know, analysts, you know, financial analysts need to do a better job of, you know, really understanding what the companies are doing. And I think a lot of financial analysts don't really understand the stuff, the companies that they're covering. But that's a whole other issue. And, you know, we don't need to get into that here.
A lot of, you know, it's the I think the lacking, that's a stock issue. Tesla's been over, even Elon Musk has said Tesla is not worth as much as the stock has said. And this was years ago, obviously, before, you know, he started making billions of stock and selling it. It's really a stock issue and, you know, an overvaluation of Tesla. And, 40% sales increase, that's in a sane world, like, good job, well played.
Yeah.
But that's not how Wall Street works. Like, it's the same thing that's happened with Apple. Every time Apple would have an event, the joke was Apple would have an event, show all these great things that millions of people are going to buy, and then the next day their stock would drop. It's just every single time. It just didn't, and it's because the analysts like expected something more. They always expected an iPhone, which was such a huge game changer, and that's. The chances of that happening every year are just no. That's not going to happen. That's like a once in a generation type of device. You know, they had the iPod, they had the iPhone, and now you're like, well, now what? And you're like, well, I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's if you look at the, it's really a lot of the financial stuff, and it doesn't help the stock when the owner or the CEO of the company is also the CEO of another company and another company and another company. And he's clearly not paying attention to really the one that makes him all the money, to be honest. And if I were I don't own any stocks in any automotive car things, anything that I cover because blah, blah, blah ethics. But if I own stock in Tesla, I'd be kind of irritated by the fact that the person who I put my trust in is over at Twitter doing whatever he's doing over there, regardless of whether or not I like Elon Musk and what he's tweeting. The fact is he has a car company he should be running, and that's where, go run your car company. I don't want to see your posts about whatever. I don't care about you, you know, especially in, just as a in the financial world is very much as black and white. I just want to make money, not lose money. That's it. There's no sort of like, oh, I like Elon Musk, I don't like Elon Musk. That's an individual thing. But in the financial world, it's just down to, well, he's not doing his job because he's over here, and they didn't hit the projections. And maybe that's because he didn't do his job, which probably isn't, but doesn't matter because that's how the financial markets work.
Yeah. All right. Enough of that. We got another question from Troy, which came in via email, and you can send those questions to feedback@wheelbearings.media. And the other thing you can also do, if you want, is you can actually record, do an audio recording, use the voice recorder on your phone to record a question or comment, and just post it somewhere on Dropbox or iCloud or OneDrive or wherever you want, and send us a link to it at feedback@wheelbearings.com, and if it's, as long as it's not too long, we'll include that in the show as well, so you can participate that way. But Troy asks, my wife currently drives a 2011 Ford Escape with 132,000 miles on the clock, so this is the second generation Escape. She's beginning to look for a new vehicle. She's 5'10", and our 8-year-old daughter is 5 foot. We tend to keep vehicles for 10 plus years. Good for you, Troy. Good plan. I like that. Trying to find something that will accommodate our growing daughter. We don't want her to be super cramped in the back seat. She's been looking at the Ford Maverick, Ford Ranger, Subaru Crosstrek Outback. And I tried selling her on an Odyssey, but she does not want to entertain a van. Bummer.
That's just me all the time. Just buy a minivan, but please go on.
Anyway. I drive an F-150 crew cab, and that has plenty of room, but it is too big for her. Understandable. It's a big truck. We live in the southeast and have to evacuate for hurricanes, so legroom and storage are key. Thoughts and questions.
Kia Carnival.
Yeah, that's right. It's not a minivan. It's not a minivan. MPV.
It's an MPV. It's a multi-purpose vehicle. It's funny because I've been thinking about this for the last 2 weeks because I'm always trying to get people into a minivan because they're like, oh, I have a kid, you know, especially if they have babies and toddlers, mm-hmm. where it's, you know, it's difficult to open that door in a crowded parking lot. And the fact that the door just slides open and you have all this room for literally everything you need to drag your child around the earth, you have that in a minivan. And then I was like, Kia Carnival. Because it's not a minivan, MPV.
and if you still can't convince your wife that it's not a minivan, you could take a look at the Sorento, another really good choice. That's not too big, it's roomy enough. What I would suggest is don't get the optional third row because it's pretty much useless anyway. Yeah. But you'll have lots of cargo space in the back, and we were just talking about vehicles getting bigger, Hyundai's been making some of their vehicles in the latest generation considerably larger. The new generation Tucson, if you want something even a little bit smaller than the Sorento, the Tucson is another excellent choice. It got like 6-8 inches longer in this current generation. It's got a lot of cargo space in the back. You can get the Tucson with a hybrid or a plug-in hybrid. With the plug-in hybrid, and actually same is true also for the Sorento, you can get the hybrid or plug-in hybrid. Those plug-in hybrids get about 34, 35 miles of electric driving range. So for your daily commute, you can pretty much do all of that on electricity alone. And then when you do need to escape from a hurricane, you don't have to necessarily worry about, where are you going to charge it along the way. You've got lots of space in the back for all the gear. So I think those are two excellent choices to consider as well.
Yeah, I'm assuming Troy is taller than his wife if she's 5'10", and their daughter, you have an 8-year-old daughter. By the time their daughter's 18, I guess they need a lot of room in the back.
Yeah.
Or she'll be driving the car. There's also that.
Yeah, could be.
Putting mom in the back or dad. Someone has to sit in the back while the daughter's driving. I guess whoever yells shotgun. So Troy, start practicing yelling shotgun now. You got 8 years to master it.
So there's some options for you, and you know, Maverick is always a good choice too. You know, you can put lots of stuff in there. Although, you know, with you know, you'll probably actually get more stuff in the Maverick. You know, even with a tonneau cover on it, than you would in any of the crossovers. But you might want to you might want to make sure you get a tonneau cover for it. To keep everything dry if you do need to escape a storm. Whereas with the crossovers, you know, you've got that space, and you know, with three of you, you know, in the crossover, you know, they all have split folding rear seats, so you can fold down one side, you know, and have more cargo space in there as well.
Yeah.
So that's a good option.
I know more people buy the Crosstrek, but the Outback's the better. That's the better deal, I think.
Yeah. That's a little bigger, more spacious.
Yeah.
So. All right. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks, everybody. And don't forget, you can send in your questions and comments to feedback@wheelbearings.media. You can find us on Mastodon and potentially other places. Not rarely checking in on Twitter anymore, but still look in once in a while. And we'll talk to you next time.
Bye.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.